So, for some reason, I seem to be telling this story a lot these days. I don't know why. It just seems to keep coming up. Maybe it's on my mind. I guess it is. So, here's how it goes. In the 1980s, I was cast as the CEO of a personal computing software company. I don't know how that happened. It was not a good role for me. It wasn't, my. Being an executive isn't really, part of my sort of makeup, but that's what what it was. And so I had a relationship with my customers, with my, I call them users. A lot of people don't like that word. I have, in all these years, never come up with a better one. And the way I looked at it is, I was making software for them, and the people that I hired, and the money that I raised, and whatever else we did as a company, the purpose of everything we did was to facilitate communication from them to us, basically. We wanted to know how they were using the product, and what limitations they were hitting, of course, what bugs were in their way, what kind of compatibility did they want between our product and other products. And so we set up mechanisms whereby it was as easy as possible for them to communicate with us. Now, we made a product for thinkers, plain and simple. We made a thing, we called it the first idea processor. And it worked it for a certain type of person, and these were very smart people, very accomplished, usually with very educated, curious, in some cases extremely rich, people who managed very complicated systems. And I think mostly the common denominator was that they were people who were aware of how they think. And so they could recognize the value of a tool that supported that process. And I'm not sure if everybody could have benefited from this product or only some. I just know that this is one of our huge advantages, was that our users were these exceptional people. The product just sought them out, and they luckily found us, and probably most of the ones that could have benefited from us never did find us. But the world was also a lot smaller then, and it was sort of easier for, and personal computers were the super hot thing, complete new capability, and people were just really, really excited about it. So, and if I had people that worked for me that weren't on board with this, they had the option of joining me in the quest. That was the way I looked at it, was, look, I'm going to be here studying these people. I'm going to be listening to them. I'm going to be soaking up every idea that they want to give us, and I'm going to try to knock down all the barriers I can for them. And you don't have to be in on this. It isn't, if I hired somebody, it's like you don't even have to really understand what the hell I'm talking about. You just have to understand one thing, is that that's why we're here. We're here for them, and it paid off. It paid off enormously. And seriously, in dollars and cents, it paid off enormously, because the idea that turned out to elevate our product from being sort of in the second tier of personal computer software products and moved it in, for a bit at least, into the top tier, was an idea that came from a user. And it was, he basically, we're doing a demo, and this was a guy, Guy Kawasaki. He worked at Apple, and and we were down there doing a demo of an early release, pre-release of our product, showed it to him, and he asked me if we could print, and I said, yes, it can print. And so we printed out a page, and he drew a box around the page, and he put bullets on each of the items, and he said, if you can do that, I can sell a shitload of this product. So I didn't hesitate. I said, yeah, well, okay, we're gonna do that. And we came back in literally a few days. We dropped everything, and that's what we did. And And he wasn't a programmer. I'm sure when he asked the question, he didn't know if our answer was going to be yes or no. The guy was a user, but really fucking smart. Smart and curious, inquisitive. I mean, we could see. We had booths at trade shows in those days, and I could tell when this person walking up to our booth or past our booth, this guy was going to stop. He was one of our users. They were so turned on. It was really something to behold. And I don't have a name for this ethos. And I actually think it's pretty rare for companies to have this kind of sense about their users. I think mostly, I mean, I know that in the early days of CompuServe, I was a very active user of that. CompuServe was sort of like a precursor to instant messaging, I guess, or chat or Slack. It had a lot of Slack in it, And the people that worked at the company, they called us the Lonely Hearts Club because they felt, well, anybody that would use our product has to be a lonely person, a sad person with no life. And in other words, it wasn't a very positive image that they had of us. And I think that's because, first of all, I mean, they were wrong. The people that used their product were the core of the leading edge. I mean, the earliest of adopters, people who were predicting something that was going to have explosive impact, not just on the computer industry, but on the entire world. So in hindsight, they were dead wrong about us. But it's a defense mechanism. It's a way of keeping the world simple and putting yourself on top of it. It's an easy thing to do. I saw people doing this in my company. I'd be walking by the lunchroom and hearing a few people, talking over just chatting about their experience with, oh, what a stupid customer, blah, blah, blah. I mean, those weren't the actual words they used. And when I heard that, I would always like U-turn, turn around, and I go, wait a minute, I just heard what you said, and that's just completely wrong. It's better to assume that they're smarter than you. Not because they are, because I hired really smart people, And I believed in them, and I developed them, and I loved them. I mean, I love them because the whole thing is built around love. It's all built around putting out that kind of energy and looking for it when it comes back. But we weren't going to get anywhere. If we had that attitude about our users, we were a small little company with every disadvantage, every reason for the world to completely flush us down the toilet. And so we were going to have to, and anybody that found us, found our product and used it and was trying to figure out how to get to work, those people were really fucking smart because out of all of the noise in the software industry, they found us and they chose us and they're with us. And if we had any other attitude about them, what future do we have if only really stupid people find us? And who are we making software for, And so why do I mention that? Because I think this is what's wrong today. I mean, what's wrong, been wrong forever. I mean, it's the antidote to what ails the journalism industry. Seriously, it's this feeling that the people who we serve are the kinds of people who are relegated to comments. And of course, that's just a cesspool. It's a bunch of people with really loud opinions and they're there. It's the Lonely Hearts Club all over again. And you may point to their messages and say, look what they wrote. It's like crazy shit. I can't listen to this. But actually, even people who are expressing themselves in really awful ways, sometimes they're right. You have to kind of step back and say, I'm going to try to separate out the expression of the idea from the actual idea itself. This is another story I told recently, but it's one of my standard stock stories. When I was doing the first BloggerCon, this was in 2003. And it was initially planned as like a really standard format conference. academic conference. I was a fellow at Berkman Center at the time, and I designed a conference that sort of followed the norms for conferences, academic conferences. And so I had a price tag on it that was, I think it was like $500. It might have been as much as $800 for a ticket for a one-day conference. And the reason why I asked for so much money, although at the time to me it didn't seem like that much money, was because I wanted to give scholarships. I wanted to fly people in. I want to have the money to do that. And so I didn't want it to simply be a regional conference, you know, from people from the Boston area or maybe from New York. I wanted some people coming that weren't rich, that didn't have the money to do it, to come from California, to come from Colorado, to come from wherever. I wanted to have a nice little budget there. And so my thought was, the people who can't or don't want to pay for it are going to tell me they can't or don't want to pay for it, and they won't have to pay for it. But I'm going to put out this thing. It's going to say the price is $800, and that's the starting point, right? And, you know, the blogosphere, it's a blogging conference, right? And the blogosphere just blew up at me. So this would be an example of, you know, me looking at them and saying, what an unreasonable bunch of fucks, you know? It's like, here I am, I'm working for free, blah, 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 all this, you know, complaining that I would be doing, and they don't appreciate me, yada, yada, yada. I'm not going to listen, right? Well, that isn't actually how I reacted. When I reacted is I thought, wow, you know, I wish I hadn't done it this way because I agree with them. And so it's like one level, you have to question yourself from that point of view before you even roll something like this out. In this case, I didn't do that. So what did I do? I said, okay, I'm going to take it at face value. I'm going to do the best that I can do here. I'm not going to pull it back because I've already got some money from people and I've made a commitment and I don't want to do a U-turn here. So what I did was I added a second day. The original conference was for Friday. I added a Saturday. And Saturday was completely free. Anybody could come, no money, just come. And we're going to have the same facilities that we had for the day before. I'm going to use some of the money to buy them lunch and a little, you know, some coffee and, you know, fruit and shit before. No shit, I'm sorry. Fruit and stuff before the thing. You know, it's a standard conference thing. And we're going to do it like a standard conference. Except I didn't have time to put together panels and stuff like that. So what I did was I said, we're going to have discussion leaders, and the room is going to, because I had no idea who was going to show up, if anybody. And I had just spent, you know, like 6 months planning that one-day conference, and I knew I didn't have time to do anything at all for the second day. Well, the outcome is, from hindsight again, they were, God damn it, were they right? They were really right. They weren't nice about it, and maybe they didn't even know why they were right, but they were. And which was the better day of the conference? Oh, by far the second day. I mean, the first day was fine. We had a bunch of like really famous people and stuff, and they told their stories and, you know, puffed their chests and do the things that people do at conferences. And you go, well, you know. And I kept having the same feeling that I had at everybody else's conference that, you know, the room has so much more knowledge than these people who are bloviating up. I mean, I don't want to put anybody down, but generally what happens is people get too in their head and they're too impressed with the honor that's been conveyed on them. And they, you know, and they go on and on and on. It's like, but at the second day, it was just open to everybody. And the discussion leaders had to do a great job. And some of them really did. And it was something else. And we did it again, and we did it again, and I did it one more time. And after that, it sort of, I don't know where it was going, but I didn't feel like doing it anymore. But they were the best conferences I've ever participated in. And so I guess the point is that you kind of have to try to see through the way the ideas are expressed. They may not come to you in the way that you want them, but they may be good ideas anyway. So what I would say to journalism is, journalism pushes all of this away. They have public editors, but the public editors aren't from the public. So what they're getting is they're putting a label on something that isn't true. Those really aren't public editors. They aren't speaking for the public. They don't have any idea what the public thinks. And when the New York Times, which has got to have the smartest user base in the entire fucking universe, when they decided to get rid of the public editor, so what little representation the public had inside their paywall, you know, it all went away. They said, oh, well, we'll just keep reading what they say on Twitter, you know. Well, they don't read what people say on Twitter. They read what other journalists say on Twitter. And so what we end up with, and I think the other, I mean, they miss the whole story in journalism. They just completely miss it because they have no idea who, we have an interest in the success of journalism just like they do. Maybe, and because there's so many more of us, when you add it all up, you know, they are very influential people, and journalism is extremely influential, but it only represents the experience of a very small number of people, and there's just no way to penetrate it. It's impenetrable. And so if a journalism company wanted to really make a difference, and you could argue that it's no different for software and journalism, I would. I mean, our products have to reflect the needs of the users every bit as much as journalism does. But since journalism is basically feeding back to us what we know, I mean, it's really just a middleman. Although they probably don't like to think about that. But that's what they are. Their job is just to assimilate things that other people know and present them in a way that we can use it. That's really what journalism amounts to. And the fact that it is so limited in perspective because they talk to so few people and they listen to so few people, that we're driving off cliffs everywhere you look. The shit is really, you know, chickens are coming home to roost, as somebody once said. It's happening right now. We have Trump in the White House. We have climate change running completely wild, and much of it irreversible. So it's not like we can wake up one day and start doing things about it as if, you know, there really won't be anything we can do when we finally figure this out at a societal level. And we kind of depend on journalism to help us communicate amongst ourselves, and they are really not doing it. They're really falling down. They're very much into their own pain, their own agony, their own fears, and really that's what they tend to write about. The answer to me is very simple. It's very, very, very simple. Is let's go back about five steps when what was published on the internet was a level playing field, and let me have, and everybody else have, an equal shot at putting something on your homepage as the people you hire. When that happens, and somebody's going to do it, I swear to God, somebody is actually going to do it and pull it off, that is when the reporters will start listening to the people. Because another thing that I've learned, I'm not going to tell you a long story because I'm like really running too long here, is that people don't listen to their friends. They listen to their enemies. And if they feel like we're competing directly with them and their future depends on understanding what we're going to be writing about next, they will be listening. And that will be good. That's the kind of shakeup journalism needs. All right, I know I've gone on too long. Thanks for listening. Talk to you later. Bye-bye.